The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, "The Business of Black Fashion." Against all odds, these fashion founders are using their brands to elevate the industry, amplify black designers, and push the culture forward. When it comes to fashion, black folks are innovators and trendsetters. Despite our contributions to the culture, however, many designers of color struggle to finance their businesses and face undeniable obstacles to staying afloat even when they do. Combined with a global pandemic and other ongoing challenges in an industry where many of us, quote unquote, aren't in the boardrooms and are absent from decision-making forums on everything from runways to awards to investors, finding and creating equity is no easy feat. Thankfully, there's been a long overdue shift since the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor last year, which provoked the racial reckoning, quote unquote, of 2020, stories of black-owned brands are finally being highlighted. Black designers across the globe are using the recognition and momentum to scale up, elevating their businesses the best way they know how, and doing it for the culture instead of for the accolades. That's not to say that some designers aren't still facing monumental challenges. Quite a few black-owned businesses shuttered during the pandemic, including Kushni, the 12-year-old New York-based luxury evening wear label helmed by Harley Kushni. The effects of COVID-19 have hurt my business beyond repair, the designer said in a statement released last October. One of the great ironies of the fashion industry is that while it caters to and profits from women, it has never felt like an industry that supports them. This is especially true for women of color. Known for sexy, sophisticated, and modern styles, Kushni was cherished by high-profile celebrities such as Jennifer Lopez and Lupita. Forced to take stock, the brand reinvented itself with Kushni for Target, which dropped in June for a limited time, offering women more accessible and affordable way to shop the label's coveted designs and silhouettes. Black women aren't the only ones facing the harsh realities of the fashion industry head on. Consider Charles Elliott Harbison, who launched his collection in 2013 to much fanfare. That September, he was featured in Vogue and was considered the next rising designer to know. Notable celebs like Michelle Obama, Beyonce, and Solange Knowles wore his clothes, yet feeling the lack of industry support and a bit of burnout, he took a much-needed break. He has since re-emerged with a women's collection for Banana Republic, which is set to debut this month. Throughout history, our designers have tried to make a name for themselves in a highly competitive, predominantly white industry that remains Eurocentric. Anne Lowe is said to be the first black woman to become a world-renowned fashion designer, rising to prominence after creating one of the most famous wedding dresses in history, the one worn by Jacqueline Lee Bouvier when she married John F. Kennedy in 1953. In the mid-1900s, Lowe's unique designs were all the rage among wealthy and privileged women, and she was even referred to as society's best-kept secret in a Saturday Evening Post from 1964. Lowe went on to open Anne Lowe's Gowns, a boutique in Harlem, and in 1968, she became the first African American to have a fashion design business. Anne Lowe's Originals on New York's Madison Avenue. Lowe was one of America's first black haute couture designers, ushering in a generation of fellow creators who would follow suit. Among them were Stephen Burroughs and Jeffrey Banks, both of whom had prominent and award-winning careers as designers of their own lines and as creative design directors for other companies. But neither Burroughs nor Banks ever reached the level of recognition they truly deserved, especially in comparison with white counterparts such as Vera Wang, Calvin Klein, Ralph Lauren, and Diane von Furstenberg, all of whom continue to have a stake in the industry today. And as in many other industries that prohibit black achievers from catapulting to the top, largely due to racism, both designers faced skepticism that persists even now when it comes to securing the investor capital needed for a fashion enterprise to sustain itself. Although it is not taught in history books, overcoming adversity and continuing to excel regardless of the circumstance is taught, learned, and applied, says Telsha Anderson, owner plus buyer of TA New York. As of recently, we have seen black designers unapologetically educate audiences on our past and present, all while moving toward the future. Today, as black fashion creators continue to influence global design trends, they are also raising awareness about the lack of equity within the industry and finding innovative ways to survive. Kirby Jean Raymond of Pyre Moss, Laquan Smith, and Telfar Clemens of Telfar are just a few standouts who are changing the fashion game in unique ways. Since its 2014 debut, Telfar's shopping bag has become one of the most sought-after fashion accessories. Ask anyone who's gone online at precisely 12 p.m. on release day to try and snag one. With a recent partnership with UGG and the ladies of the Real Housewives of Potomac, not to mention a Telfar bag spotted on the arm of Queen Bey herself, there's no denying that the line has produced the new quote-unquote it bag. Many celebrities and influencers have also been spotted carrying the Bushwick Birkin, which has made the brand one of the most profitable black fashion success stories of the year. And Clemens did it on his own terms, circumventing traditional marketing channels and connecting with his consumers online. Another black fashion innovator is Anifa Fuemba, the designer behind the clothing line Hanifa, which made runway shows more accessible to the masses by using 3D digital models to launch the brand's new collections online. The move was in response to the uncertainty that continues to loom over the fashion industry, with brands having to rethink strategies to accommodate COVID-19 protocols and adapt to the unprecedented nature of the times. By solving a problem caused by the need to quarantine due to the global pandemic, Hanifa had the internet buzzing, and while the industry is so not a stranger to technology, the Hanifa presentation was a groundbreaking display of what will likely become fashion's new normal as brands embrace hybrid virtual and in-person experiences. And then there's Pyre Moss's runway show, which marked founder Jean Raymond's couture debut at Villa Loiro, a 20,000 square foot mansion built and lived in by Madam C.J. Walker. The show celebrated black inventors, and the designs, like the show itself, were unapologetically black and didn't give a blank about the opinions of the fashion establishment. It would be wrong not to mention Brandon Blackwood and how his his career has catapulted since the debut of his small tote bag bearing the words "and systemic racism." As happened with Telfar, his bag became one of the year's biggest fashion statements. Since then, Blackwood has launched his collection of 500 ESR bags, eventually expanding the line into 37 different colors and materials. Blackwood's is another tale of a designer forging his own path to equity and giving brands a history lesson along the way. His bags now sell in the high-end retailers that once rejected the designs. As a designer of color, you are automatically given a questioning eye, he once reflected. You have to be a little bit more talented and have a little more business savvy than your white counterparts. When you do see a talented black kid making their way through, even if they are celebrated, they are still questioned. You are also working with institutions and magazines that are predominantly white, and the only people that look like you are the interns and the messengers. Though recognition for all these designers is well overdue, black creatives in fashion are still playing catch up when it comes to securing financing and longevity in the industry. We have been here, Smith stated, to address the issue of tokenism in the fashion world. Now that the country's in an uproar, a lot of people are overcompensating to show, I'm not racist, but you're still grouping all these random designers in one box. And while some designers are using their art to advocate, others are using their voice. Creative director, activist, and fashion designer Aurora James, for example, created the 15% pledge, which asks retailers to devote 15% of their shelf space to black-owned businesses. This initiative has sparked a movement, and comments from brands including Macy's, Inc., Sephora USA, Inc., and West Elm. One thing is sure, the next generation of designers will owe a debt to the current wave of black creators who are running profitable fashion businesses on their own terms while pushing for social and financial equity despite the odds. They are already making an impact on the industry as a whole and writing the legacy they will leave behind. The next article is titled "Old World, New World." 4 years after their love story made global headlines, we catch up with Prince Joel David McKinnon and Princess Ariana McKinnon, who are living in LA and moving with purpose. Royal weddings always attract considerable attention, but when Prince Joel David McKinnon, the great-grandson of His Imperial Majesty Emperor Haile Selassie I of Ethiopia, and Ariana Austin, granddaughter of a former Lord Mayor of Georgetown, Guyana, wed on September 9, 2017. They couldn't have foreseen the interest their nuptials would generate. Not only did their love story go viral in the United States, but it grabbed attention in places that have left them amazed to this day. "We were so genuinely heartened by people's reactions," Princess Ariana says. "We got messages and DMs from all around the world. It was a lovely surprise, and we were just kind of excited by everyone's excitement. People from Asia to Brazil, and of course throughout Africa, were not only enthralled by the couple's unique love story, but were likely proud to see black royalty out of Africa featured in such a positive, hopeful way." Ariana Austin first encountered her prince at a nightclub in her native Washington, D.C. after having recently graduated from college. She had returned to the city, studying abroad at the University of Oxford, and would later pursue a master's in arts education and creative writing at Harvard University. At the time the couple met, Prince Joel was a student at American University. He would later obtain a law degree from Howard University. Though a part of the Solomonic dynasty, Prince Joel would keep that information private upon their introduction. That night, they were simply two young people at Pearl making a connection. A decade after their first meeting, the two said their vows in a lavish ceremony befitting royalty. We were really proud to be able to represent Black cachet and Black excellence like that, because our wedding happened to be just 8 months before Meghan Markle's to Prince Harry, says Prince Joel. A Black woman marrying into the British monarchy, we know that story. So I think that people were really happily surprised to see how Africa was represented. Ethiopia has this long history, a long monarchy. It is just a very ancient culture that is truly ours, and we were really proud to be able to represent that for people. Such representation comes with a lot of responsibility. That's why when the couple was flooded with offers to share their lives on reality TV and in film following their wedding, they were hesitant. They subsequently passed on these proposals, instead opting to found their own media company. The most important thing for us was to do all of this on our terms. Princess Ariana says, we needed to take the time to sift through these offers, whether it was the BBC or whomever, to decide what we should do. Understandably, the couple wanted to be very intentional about how they chose to move forward. All the publicity came and it was exciting, but it was never really the goal, Prince Joel recalls. We didn't go in there thinking, okay, we are going to make this big splash and then we are going to have a book deal and a TV show. When it came, it was great. But with all the opportunities and offers, what we thought was, now that we do have this platform and this publicity, what can we do on our own terms? While the couple considered the possibilities, they shut out all the media noise and attention and focused on getting settled into married life. For the first year, they lived what Prince Joel describes as an extended honeymoon of traveling and fun. They also engaged in doing things that royals do, including attending balls, galas, and all the high society events that are a staple of the DC diplomatic community. Eventually, they found a way to combine their full individual lives into a shared home, which they established in Los Angeles. They since filled their abode with decor and detail that blend their old and new world sensibilities. In one room, for example, a large portrait of H.I.M. Emperor Haile Selassie sits next to a gilt-framed mirror on which the princess likes to write classic quotes from some of her favorite authors. It's a perfect expression of how the couple embraces personal history while showcasing contemporary art and statement pieces. We both grew up in families that were very social, says Princess Ariana. My parents hosted monthly cultural salons, and I definitely wanted to recreate that in my home. I wanted a place that I felt comfortable, but also really artistically and culturally rich. And Joel was the same. Obviously, his things feel a bit more weighty, more old world. We joke that our home is an old world, new world combination. The royal couple also make room to explore their independent hobbies and passions. Prince Joel enjoys golfing and long distance biking to places like Santa Monica and Venice Beach. And Princess Ariana, who used to work in the visual arts field, is involved in curating art events, from gallery openings to cultural affairs. As a team, they are deeply devoted to storytelling as a way to make a difference in the diaspora community. It's why they created their own media and entertainment company, Old World, New World, named after their shared aesthetic. Remembering how their love story inspired people the world over, they decided they wanted to keep providing compelling Black stories, both fiction and nonfiction, that would entertain and enlighten while being rooted in a rich history. With our media company, we can continue to establish this brand we have now, a Black couple with aspirations, telling powerful Black stories that uplift and inspire people and make them feel as they did about our wedding, Prince Joel says. These are the stories that have motivated us, so now we want to bring them to a bigger audience. One of their first offerings is a young adult science fiction novel called Last Gate of the Emperor, which Prince Joel co-authored with New York Times best-selling author Kwame Mbalia. The plot blends fantasy with real references to Ethiopian culture and past events. I thought it would be great to put our history in this story that kids can enjoy, but at the same time, they're being educated about a new part of the world, the prince says. It's the first of many planned projects as the prince and princess begin to build their media company. In coming years, they hope to do a biopic feature film on Emperor Selassie, publish more books, and develop a TV series. The overall mission of their work is to unify the diaspora. As for what's next for the couple, in a more personal vein, their plans include starting a family, continuing to travel, and living in a way that makes them happy, while also making proud their many supporters near and far in both the old world and the new. As Prince Joel sums up, we want to create a legacy together that's more lasting and meaningful than a quick 15 minutes of fame. This next article includes adult material and may not be appropriate for children. The next article is titled, 8 Ways to Better Sex. Now that you have returned to the office and the kids are back in school, it's time to return to good times between the sheets with a little help from the experts. Has your sex life seen steamier days? If so, you're in good company, sis. We asked a few of our favorite sex perts for their best tips on turning up the heat. Take notes. Number 1, hold please. Believe it or not, step 1 on the road to great sex could be putting it on hold for a while. No orgasmic sex together for 2 weeks, says sex therapist Dr. Lex Brown James, who runs the Institute for Sexuality and Intimacy. This helps to take the pressure off of sex. We don't need one person trying to initiate or one person being scared of rejection. Putting sex on pause allows you to explore other forms of intimacy. You can do some solo play if that's okay for your relationship, Brown James says. It's about getting back to sensuality. She also recommends that couples try romantic massages and avoid each other's genitals. You have to touch other parts of the body and find those pleasure spots, she says. Don't be surprised if you start to feel stimulated in unexpected places, like your ankles. Once your body gets really hot and bothered, you discover secondary hot spots, she adds. Now, go find them. Number 2, foreplay all day. Being mindful about your approach to foreplay with your partner could open up a whole new world of pleasure possibilities. Shadeen Francis, a sex therapist, suggests you reimagine the margins of foreplay. A lot of couples stop touching when it is not about sex, she says. But what if foreplay is actually all of the opportunities that you take in your day to experience the pleasure of touch? Think beyond the sexual encounters, Frances explains. She encourages couples to be intentional about touch, like holding hands while watching TV or giving more lingering hugs. Don't do anything else, she continues. Just focus on each other for at least 10 deep breaths in through the nose, out through the mouth. It can be really intimate experience to sync up your breath. Number 3, X marks the spot. You don't need a partner to better understand how your body experiences pleasure. Yushimi Osai, a pelvic health physical therapist and sex counselor, tells her single clients to spend more quality time alone. Do a mindfulness shower or bath where you get your loaf of sponge and just go in and feel what the water and sponge's texture feel like moving over your body, says Osa. And then just be like, now my body's craving vibration, but I want it on my inner thighs. Then I'm going to move to my lower abdomen, pubic bone, and other places. Start to design your own pleasure tracks. Number 4, what's your sex number? It's not what you're thinking. If you could choose how often you would want to have sex in 1 week, what would your number be? Ask Louisiana-based sexologist Shamra Howard, LCSW. The reason that this question is super helpful is a lot of times people take it personally when their partner doesn't want to have sex. Being transparent about your number will help to eliminate uncomfortable moments when you might judge or resent your other half, and instead get you both on the same page. A partner might be tired, or they might be experiencing low sexual desire, Howard points out. Couples don't always have the same level of sexual desire, and that's okay. Number 5. Body gratitude. What Howard refers to as naked homework can help you become more vulnerable with your partner. To prepare for this fun exercise that Howard tells us is beloved by sexologists, simply carve out some alone time together, get naked, get comfortable, and unplug from technology. Sit down for at least 5 to 10 minutes and just offer gratitude to your partner's different body parts, she says. You might look at a body part you want to give gratitude and say, I really love how big and strong your arms are because of the way you hold me. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.